ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, Politics Now listeners. I'm sure you've had that experience where sometimes our futures turn in an instant.
It's like the butterfly effect.
Someone we meet, a phone call, a flyer on a notice board.
We're all vulnerable.
And it's not until later that we see the signs. When four people vanish from an isolated WA town in 2007, everyone's left wondering what they missed and what they could have done differently. I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, the Nanup 4. Binge all episodes now. Search Expanse on ABC Listen and iView.
The US president's security is facing scrutiny once again after a major breach at the White House correspondents' dinner. It's not the first time US President Donald Trump has faced political violence as extremism and violence continue to infect the US. And while Anthony Albanese has joined with other world leaders to express gratitude that the president was unharmed, back home, support for Donald Trump and for the US alliance at large is crumbling. But while the PM manages the diplomatic tightrope, One Nation's broad support of Donald Trump could see them face some blowback of their own. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelas.
And I'm Jacob Greber.
Jacob, the correspondents' dinner was obviously all the things we're talking about now because it's quite shocking what we've seen. We're going to get back to our domestic agenda in this chat, so we'll come to that, including the Farah by-election that I know you and I are both watching pretty closely. But first, those scenes at that dinner, attendees were, you know, mid-meal when a member of the White House security detail appeared calling for people to get down after shots were fired. Secret Service agents shouting, shots fired, stay down. It was obviously all filmed. I mean, this is a room, just to be clear, full of literal journalists who document every moment. So there's a lot of footage, and it's obviously kind of very stressful just to even watch, let alone be in that environment. The US President Donald Trump and his cabinet members were rushed out. They were not hurt, but there's a big discussion now about how close the shooter got. He wrote a manifesto. We're not going to get into all of that, but I think the broader story is the level of political violence in the US is not necessarily new, but it seems accelerated. Is that fair?
Yeah, it feels like they're always doing this over there. Like, it's just that
I said not new.
Not new. Maybe there's more of it. Yeah. I mean, this is not the first time. In fact, Donald Trump has been targeted famously during the election campaign for his second win. What was it? It was sort of 2-3 months out, wasn't it, from the November election.
He was
fired at and incredibly lucky there, I suspect, to survive, given how close that was. This feels like the person doing the shooting was a little further away. It seemed like they got on their feet and whisked him out of there, including the vice president and, as you say, some of the other cabinet people. But the thing about it is it's all live. That correspondents' dinner is broadcast. So it's a heck of a public sort of place for something like this to have gone down. So it's a searing image yet again of political violence that you see in America from time to time. And I think the White House was pretty quick after that to call for a calming of that type of, what are they saying there, the sort of rhetoric that encourages perhaps people to behave in certain ways.
Mm. Having said that, of course, the history and the complexity of all of this is that the US president has been accused of upping the temperature, not lowering the temperature, so the White House can ask for that, and they should be, because any normal administration should be asking for a lowering of the temperature and rhetoric. But, we can't ignore the history either of violence and the way it's become increasingly normalised. Now, look, you know, there's a huge discussion, and there will be, about whether there's been a failure of security, whether there was enough security, how did this gunman get so close to the president? I've actually found President Trump's response to this really interesting, where he said, well, he didn't get into the room, basically, right?
Well, the big people with guns and flak jackets seem to be on that stage reasonably quickly. I did think it was interesting. You know, the Australian Prime Minister was very quick to tweet that he was pleased that everyone was in, that everyone was safe. And he's sounds like he's now using that text number that he's got to send messages directly to Donald Trump to, I guess, reassure him. Does it change people's sentiment about Donald Trump, do you think? These types of things? That's always the question I always ask myself.
Great question. Is it changing? Well, we'll see, because he's really struggling, of course, in the US because he's in the middle of a war that he doesn't look like he's able to conclude. In Australia, though, what do I reckon? Well, I think in Australia it doesn't really make much of a difference. He is kryptonite in Australia. I wrote a piece on the ABC Online about this. The link is on the show notes. Talbot Mills.
There's interesting numbers in that, isn't there? The sort of level of disapproval when anyone tries to sort of sound a bit Trumpy in Australia at backlash. There's a sort of immediate sort of ick factor, isn't there?
Oh, it's absolutely. Interestingly, like if you look at this is, you know, in terms of polling land, 66% of Australians disapprove of the way Trump is doing his job. 66%. Now, there's two things about this. One is, well, that's meaningless. They don't vote on the US president, right? However, the fact that we are in lockstep with the US and our own prime minister, you know, has been so diplomatic in his management of the Trump relationship. The big question is there blowback as a result of being too close to a man that is so unpopular and toxic in our country? That's the big question. We don't know that answer. I personally think Albanese is still walking a very difficult, but he's walking it well, line between distancing himself from what the US is doing, but equally not being gratuitous or joining any kind of rebuke of the president, which gets him into trouble and risks the alliance. But it is a tricky, I don't know if it's going to continue to be easy to do. I mean, it's clearly already not easy to do.
And the prime minister sort of follows a multi-track course, doesn't he, with this? Like he didn't leap to join the, what was it, the peace board that was going to fix Gaza. He didn't sort of get involved in that initiative from the president. But then he'll talk to him about other things, famously the Iranian soccer team, that midnight conversation that they had about how to manage that particular issue. And then what's happening in reality around the country is that we continue to build up the alliance relationship. What's going on in WA with the build out there of the submarine facility, that's going at great pace, I'm told, by people who watch this stuff. And so the Americans, you know, they'll start using that base a lot more heavily in coming years, as they will the facilities in our north. So we're becoming much more deeply enmeshed in this
embedded at a structural level.
At the same
level.
Time, yeah, at a structural level, at the same time that that we sort of – the population is sort of looking askance at Trump and his influence. And I thought your interview with him last week was really interesting, that question, you know, that you asked the PM about whether he'd invite Trump out here. Now, of course he's going to say yes, isn't he? Because he can't not invite the president of one of our most important allies. But I also bet he's secretly hoping he says no.
Yeah, yeah, I thought that too. Because imagine if he said, he's not about to, guys, but imagine if he said, yeah, I really want to do that. And we had to pull out the red carpet for this, as I say, political kryptonite figure.
It would be spectacular,
yeah,
wouldn't it?
And the management of that from the Albanese government, like, not fun. Oh, and then the question, will he address the parliament? All of those things. Oh, lordy, not fun. But yes, the PM was rather, you know, he still sounds like he's really enthusiastic about the idea, though, which always makes me laugh, because he either, yeah, he's just very good at, I suppose, doing his job of tick box Australian leader that will continue the US alliance and will not falter on it.
Please, please, please don't say yes.
So, okay, at the same time, of course, the thing that's made Trump particularly unpopular, which of course is the war and the domestic prices and fallout of the war continues. Penny Wong is off on a regional tour of her own, hot off the heels of the PM's recent trip. So she's going to Japan, China and Korea, again trying to deal with our supply chain issues, mainly, of course, fuel and what happens around that next. But what this war and Donald Trump's growing unpopularity around the world and clearly in Australia has been able to reveal, and I want to go to this now, is how people, domestic political players, can try and use it to hurt each other. And right now we're seeing that in live time where the left broadly is trying to hurt Hanson and One Nation by pointing out to the public, and they're doing it in the by-election of Farrah, where One Nation is clearly ahead, certainly ahead of the Liberal Party on the polling, trying to paint them as too much cheerleaders of Trump. Now, in that polling, I mentioned the Talbot Mills polling, which is a Labor-aligned polling firm. It also shows that actually One Nation voters are less worried about the war and Trump, interestingly too. So I think their base, whatever that is, of One Nation supporters aren't as worried about that. It's more the other voters that they want to get voting for them who may have apprehensions. Is that fair?
So you're saying that people who vote for Pauline Hanson are not as worried about the war
yep.
as other cohorts mm-hmm. of voters. Mm-hmm. Well, that is very interesting.
I just want to point to those figures just to back it up. So the results that I'm referring to by Talbot Mills, it's fairly consistent across demographic groups in terms of disapproval of the war, but One Nation voters were less likely to be concerned about the conflict.
So they're still concerned, but less likely to be.
74% still concerned versus 85% overall.
Yeah.
Now, one of the interesting things that I just want to go to in terms of One Nation is the coalition preferencing One Nation above the independent in the seat of Farrah and the blowback from that. And David Spears interviewed Angus Taylor, who's the opposition leader, about that. I want to hear from you, Jacob, what you thought of Angus Taylor's answer.
First off, I was a little surprised at how little attention this got last week.
Me too.
Because it is such a decisive element in this campaign. It's not that it's the first time this will have happened. It isn't. But it now matters like never before, in that if the One Nation candidate gets up, it will be in no small measure to the way preferences have flowed, because it's that close with the independent. And Angus Taylor, in arguing for why they're going to preference One Nation ahead of the independent, saying that he would prefer a One Nation over what he called a teal independent. Now, we're going to have an argument about whether Michelle Millthorpe, who's the independent, is teal. People down in the electorate were not telling me that she was a teal. She was more orange colour, I think, was what she chose, as in to say more of a rural-focused on agricultural issues. And I think the number one issue down in Albury, for instance, is the need for a hospital. Everyone agrees on that.
Yeah.
So she is not the same as one of the independents that's won one of the inner city seats in Melbourne or Sydney. I don't think she talks about the same thing. She does say things like, yeah, maybe we have had too much immigration. Anyway, that's just to say she's not – the Liberal Party and the National Party are very eager to brand her as a teal. Backed by Climate 200 and therefore beyond the pale in their view. The problem is that they may well be opening the door to something that has never happened in the 30 years, and this is actually the 30th year since Pauline Hanson rose, for all the noise and for all the heat that she's able to generate on a very regular basis, she has never won a lower house seat. Never. She got into the lower house originally in 1996, because the Liberal Party, the way it went was they fired her very shortly before that election after she said things about Indigenous Australians. And so she appeared on the ballot as a Liberal. She was not a One Nation candidate. That came much later. And she's won, she and her party have won Senate seats, but they haven't been able to crack this holy grail of a lower house seat. And one of the reasons for that is the Liberals and the Nats would preference Labor quite often before they preferenced One Nation. That's now changed. Now, does it matter? I don't know. You now have the first One Nation MP potentially coming into Parliament. They'll get resources. What message, PK, does that send to a voter who's thinking, you know what? I've been told for 30 years that I can't possibly vote for One Nation. I have to vote for the Nationals or the Liberal Party. Yet, now what's the message?
Well, the world's upside down world, right? Like the whole rhetoric has changed around One Nation. I think it was really fascinating that Angus Taylor, and he certainly was given every chance, did not directly criticise Pauline Hanson, did not directly criticise her immigration policy in any kind of strong way. Of course, he said his was a bit different, but only a bit. Do you know what I mean? It was only like, only a little bit, just a
he's
tiny bit.
He's so eager not to pick a fight or clash with anything she does or says. And it's in such contrast to what someone like Matt Canavan or Andrew Hastie are willing to do.
Matt Canavan being the best example because he's the leader of the Nationals and therefore obviously one of the leaders that Angus Taylor is in opposition with, right? He goes hard after Pauline Hanson. Now, maybe it's a good cop, bad cop strategy. In fact, I'm interviewing Matt Canavan today. I'll ask him that. Is it a good cop, bad cop strategy? Is it a strategy? Are they just going it alone? I mean, obviously they're running separately in this seat.
Whether it's strategic or not, I do think Angus Taylor is queasy about going after Pauline Hanson. I think he worries about the kind of signal that sends.
That's exactly
right. To the conservative base of the Liberal Party. So he always pulls his punches
on that. But why doesn't Matt Canavan, which is the good cop, bad cop, because he's not worried about what the right, well, he might be a little bit worried. I don't know what he secretly feels, but he doesn't look very worried about how it's going to look for him. Pauline Hanson and Matt Canavan actually attended an anti-mass migration rally in Canberra on the weekend. So Matt Canavan's leaning into those sorts of campaigns, which are very contentious. Like even the language of mass immigration is a pretty highly loaded term. And I don't know what the evidence of mass migration to the country are. That's a fact check comment. I don't think we've got mass migration into our country. Am I missing something?
They tend to use that 1 year, was it two, 3 years after the pandemic when there was a big spike. There was a big spike after we'd had a couple of years where basically the borders were shut. And there has been a big increase on average, but it's to call it mass is that's doing a lot of work in that sentence. But that rally was fascinating, PK, because, I mean, that's where the heat is in this debate and that's where they're going. How does that play out in Farah? Farah is an electorate where parts of it are very reliant on immigrants and migration and skilled labour that comes in. It wouldn't function without that human resource that comes in every year. There isn't a coffee shop, you know, west of the monument, as they say, in Albury, apparently. I learnt this over the weekend. West of the monument, Patricia, is west of Albury,
yeah,
okay?
West
that's some
of the
local
monument.
Lingo for you. there's a giant monument in above town in Albury.
I do love a monument.
And then, of course, Griffith, famously Griffith. All those fruit pickers, all those agricultural mm-hmm. workers, that town doesn't function without it. I think I was listening to the mayor this morning saying they need something like 500 people every day.
Yeah, I know, they're desperate for people. So why do you think you're hearing the One Nation candidate who's ahead on the polling say not so many negative things about immigrants? And to her credit, politically, I don't think the One Nation leader, Pauline Hanson's really been rebuking him. So she's obviously reading a bit the room of the area that they're trying to win the seat in. I am confused, though. Maybe politics is being upended about how you can do that, but then front anti-immigration rallies somewhere else and that somehow voters all think that makes sense. Do you get that? I don't know. Like in my political historical observations, that's always very hard to do. Perhaps they're finding a way. I don't know. It was also revealed today, can I say, that the One Nation candidate had also danced with Labor. Like this is a sort of candidate that's been around the block politically, yeah?
Are you talking about David Farley?
Yes, I am.
Well, he was a businessman back in the day. You know, he was head of the Australian Agricultural Company, very, very big agribusiness, big exporter. He would be very familiar with the need for skilled labor in some of those industries. And his tune is very different to what you might expect. So I'm sure he's doing it for good reason. It'll be interesting to see. That seat has always been a conservative seat. Like it's been either the Liberal Party or the National Party since it was created, I think just during or at the end of World War II. And it's only now that they're starting to wonder whether they want to go the road of an independent, maybe more like a Helen Haynes type country independent. And that's the test. That's going to be what's interesting. But you can't just win Albury in that electorate. You have to win other areas. If you just win Albury, you won't quite get there.
Albury, not enough. So it brings me to some of the ways that the opposition leader also dealt with questions around immigration more broadly, asked by David Spears about their immigration policy and this idea of the notion that people coming from so-called bad countries are more risky. What do you think of the way he answered that? He said basically there are many good people that come from bad countries, but then he kind of floundered when David Spears asked if China was a bad country and then got himself tied in a few knots, I think.
Well, you're on a sticky paper there, aren't you? Once you start getting into this debate, like what's a, he also asserted in his original speech to the Menzies Institute a couple of weeks ago, that line about people from liberal democracies tend to be, he seemed to imply they are better migrants than people that come from dictatorships and countries led by religious fundamentalists and some of the other things. One of the problems with that is there's not actually enough migrants from liberal democracies, because liberal democracies are all competing for the same thing, which is young, skilled people. And they tend to be coming from other places. And this is where it then gets very tricky to define. And as you say, China, he sort of floundered a little bit around the answer to that. What about India? Mm. India is a democracy. Is it liberal enough to fit his categories that are good or not?
Well, he's trying to walk both sides of the street, isn't he? He's trying to say our policy, ours being the coalition's policy, is non-discriminatory. It's only discriminating on values. But then, yeah, there are bad countries which make you a bit more high risk, but it's all about the person, but it's also about the values, but it's also about whether you're from a liberal democracy. And I don't know, how is that all consistent? It doesn't sound consistent to me.
I also struggle to see how it keeps the Liberal Party in line with some of those big communities that already exist in our country. And I'm thinking here of the Indian community.
The Indian and the Chinese community. Yeah.
Massive, massive communities.
You would be trying to win them, wouldn't you, if you wanted to win a general election?
You might just want to be thinking about that. I reckon. Because they were the ones that punished you a year ago in the election with a vengeance. And I've spoken to people in the National Party who get very, very cross about the Pauline Hanson type immigration debate. When you suggest that the National Party might be dallying with that sort of thing, they reject that. And they say, you know, we have a National Party deputy leader in New South Wales now who's from the Sikh community on the coast. They make that point that they are connected to some of those big migrant communities because they know those communities matter and that those communities get very, very anxious when the rhetoric goes up about who's good and who's not good.
Mm. Yeah, and they feel targeted. And it also allows, even if your argument, as Angus Taylor, is they're not being targeted, they're not my targets, it allows for that politically, just on a pure political level, for that to be exploited because you've left yourself wide open. And that is dangerous too, right? So it's also not smart politics to do that. Look, I just want to end the pod, if I can, just reflecting on, of course, Anzac Day was over the weekend. Some people are experiencing public holidays as a result. We're not in Victoria, actually, but it obviously happened on Saturday. And we saw at a couple of the Anzac Day ceremonies, including Sydney, booing during the welcome to country, which is clearly repulsive and disrespectful. Now this is the second year running that this has happened. So is this our new normal? That's the big question I have and I want to raise somewhere. So I'm doing it here because we have a daily podcast, Jacob. So let's do it. Is this our new normal now that we have the most somber, significant ceremony in our country, which commemorates people dying on the front lines of very significant wars that our country has committed them to? And we are now marring them, not we, but you know what I mean, people who are coming with this sort of behaviour, which is so repulsive. Now, Angus Taylor, when questioned by David Spears, he said it was wrong to boo. But now you know, we're having another endless, it seems to me, and repetitive discussion about welcome to countries. He was also asked about those. It's very much a culture war. And he said, you know, he thinks they happen too often.
So is he saying they shouldn't be, it shouldn't be a part of Anzac Day, but specifically on Anzac Day?
I think there's an ambiguity about what he thinks about whether it should be Anzac Day or not. It's clearly a very good question to ask. Generally, are they overused? Some people think they are, and I know some Aboriginal people think they are, by the way, like it's not. But making that at the centre of our discussion, I don't know, it's like it's Anzac Day. Indigenous people died on the front line who actually even enlisted, who were not kind of seen as full citizens in this country. Like, just the whole thing just smacks of something's gone off. Something's gone wrong.
Something's gone wrong. I you know, you hope it doesn't become a theme. The thing about it is the vast majority of the crowd there at that service would not have done that, would not have been part of that. You only need a tiny handful of people and they become the story. That's sort of the unfortunate part of that. There's a really nice piece in the Sydney Morning Herald this morning from Bevan Shields. In fact, it went up yesterday about Uncle Ray, who was giving, you know, who was giving the welcome to country. Uncle Ray served in the army. His brothers and grandfather fought in the wars. If you wanted someone appropriate to do a welcome to country, it'd surely be someone like him.
Yeah, and on that note, that's it for Politics Now today. Jacob, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow, Melissa Clark will join me for the latest political developments. If you have a question for us, send a short voice note to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. If you haven't listened to our Question Time episode with Chief Elections Analyst Casey Briggs, please do so. It was a lot of fun, and also linked in the show notes. See you, Jacob.
Take care.